What we're going to look at next is the third major capital flow, and this comes directly from the events that we've laid the that we've already discussed. Those could be thought of as the foundation for this, and this next major capital flow is the flow of capital from the declining Nazi Empire into 750 corporate fronts that were established in neutral countries. This flight capital organization is the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization that I've spoken about many times in the past, an institution that I think will ultimately prove to be the deciding element in human affairs on this planet. And in taking a look at this third major capital flow, the flow of capital from Nazi-occupied Europe into the 750 corporate fronts in neutral countries, we're going to once again rely on the definitive text about the Bormann organization, a brilliant and heroic book authored by Paul Manning. Paul Manning was part of the CBS News team that covered the war in Europe, along with Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. And in 1981, he published a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. That book was published in hardcover and softcover by Lyle Stewart Press. And the ISBN number is 0-8184-0309-8. And of the third major capital flow, the flow of capital into the 750 corporate fronts established in neutral countries for the Bormann Flight Capital Program, Manning writes as follows. 750 new corporations were established in the last months of the war under the directions of Reichsleiter Bormann using the technique perfected by Hermann Schmitz of IG Farben. A national of each country was the nominal head of each corporate structure, and the board was a mix of German administrators and bank officials, while the staffing at senior and middle management levels was comprised of German scientists and technicians. In the background were the shadowy owners of the corporation, those Germans who possessed the bearer bonds as proof of stock ownership. The establishment of such companies, usually launched in industries requiring high technical skills, was welcomed in Spain and Argentina, to give two examples, because those governments appreciated that German companies would generate jobs and implement a more favorable balance of trade. Country by country, a breakdown by U.S. Treasury investigators of these new 750 German firms was as follows. Portugal, 58. Spain, 112. Sweden, 233. Switzerland, 214. Turkey, 35. And Argentina, 98. And the flow of capital from occupied Europe into the 750 corporate fronts is the third of the major capital flows in this hydraulic model that we're looking at. What we're going to look at next is the role of some of the key American members of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, both the Wall Street faction and the Regis State Department faction, in perpetuating this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, sustaining the German industrial and financial elite, the German end of this axis and their associates, and ultimately affecting the next major capital flow number 4, which was the Marshall Plan, the 50th anniversary of which was recently observed and celebrated, as I speak, in late June of 1998. We took a look at the Regia faction of the State Department, and Robert Murphy of the State Department was one of the key Regia faction members who helped to sustain and restore the German financial and industrial elite to power after World War II. Speaking of denazification, Christopher Simpson writes as follows in The Splendid Blonde Beast, "But a written policy, that being denazification, is one thing. Its implementation is quite another. State Department's Robert Murphy took personal charge of the political oversight of U.S. denazification work in Germany almost immediately, and he made little secret of his inclinations. Meanwhile, the sensitive task of overseeing U.S. intelligence evaluations of German business and political leaders fell to an enterprising OSS man who was stationed in Berlin shortly after Hitler's suicide. That man was Alan Dulles." As we've seen, Alan Dulles was, along with his partner, his brother John Foster Dulles, a partner in Sullivan and Cromwell, one of the key players in this transatlantic financial and industrial axis and the resulting capital flows. Of Dulles and his work in Berlin, Simpson writes as follows in Splendid Blonde Beast, "Dulles became one of Robert Murphy's most strategically placed allies inside occupied Germany. Beginning in early 1945, Dulles provided clearances for senior German bankers and industrialists seeking permission to remain active in Germany's post-war economy. As an OSS chief in Allied-occupied Berlin, he personally oversaw compilation of white lists, unquote, of non-Nazi German executives believed to be useful for German reconstruction. He thus exercised considerable influence during the first months of the war over the day-to-day implementation of U.S. policy concerning German business leaders. And with the aforementioned Robert Murphy, and also with William Draper, one of the key officials from Dillon Reed that we looked at in our first segment, Alan Dulles was instrumental in perpetuating the position of the German end of this Axis in power in the post-World War II period. William Draper of Dillon Reed became General William Draper and was one of the key military officials overseeing German reconstruction. Of William Draper, Christopher Simpson writes, Dillon Reed and company partner William Draper became pivotal to the semi-clandestine shift in U.S. policy toward Germany that summer. By 1945, Secretary of War Stimson and Secretary of the Navy Forrestal, Dillon Reed's former president, engineered Draper's appointment as Chief of the Economic Division of the Joint Allied Control Council for Germany, the Central Occupation Government at the time, and as Director of Economic Policy for the German territories administered by the U.S. As such, Draper emerged as by far the most powerful U.S. industrial and finance official in occupied Germany, with overall authority for implementing Joint Chiefs of Staff Directive 1067, and other U.S. denazification programs aimed at German bankers and businessmen. Draper was an imposing, broad-chested man with a bald pate of dark, bristling eyebrows that emphasized his high forehead. Prior to the war, he had been corporate treasurer at Dillon Reed and an officer of the German Credit and Investment Corporation of New Jersey, a Dillon Reed-sponsored holding company that specialized in international investments in Hitler-era Germany. As should not be surprising, with people like Robert Murphy of the State Department, people like Alan Dulles working in the intelligence community, and people like William Draper overseeing the actual occupation of Germany, the reinstitution, or the perpetuation, really would be a better way of putting it, of the German financial and industrial elite, the German end of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, was assured and, in fact, took place. Denazification was tossed out the window and replaced by a policy very similar to the policy endorsed by the Rege faction and their allies on Wall Street of building up German industry as a bulwark against not only the Soviet Union but the possibility of revolution in Central or Eastern Europe. Of the frustration of denazification, Christopher Simpson writes as follows. But at least as early as December of 1945, the opposite formulation came to the fore, even in official documents. Now, it was the denazification effort that was seen as the source of disaffection. Opposition within the U.S. to denazification and decartelization in Germany was led almost exclusively by the corporate and foreign policy elite that had been most active in U.S.-German financial relations during the 1920s and 1930s. The disproportionate political leverage of this group, its ability to shape media coverage of foreign policy issues, to influence government policy, and eventually to shift public opinion was dramatically manifested in the realignment of U.S. policy concerning denazification and decartelization in the brief period between 1945 and 1947. One of this group's most effective lobbying tactics was sponsorship of junkets to Europe by American politicians and businessmen financed by U.S. multinationals to, quote, study the problem of German recovery, unquote. Draper paid close attention to these visits, staging elaborate briefings intended to shape public opinion at home concerning the professional realities of business in Europe. These events were almost ceremonial. The attendees and the briefers had selected one another largely through their existing social networks based in powerful U.S. companies with investments in Europe. The men on both sides of Draper's briefing table were receptive to his message and usually knew pretty well what it would be. The next major capital flow, the fourth capital flow that we're going to look at, concerns the flow of capital once again from North America to Europe, Germany in particular, and this capital flow took place under the Marshall Plan, the 50th anniversary of which was just celebrated, again as I speak, in late June of 1998. Now, the Brown referred to here is a Lewis H. Brown, who wrote a book advocating the perpetuation of the economic status quo in Germany and the perpetuation of the German business elite in positions of power. Philip Reed, or the Reed referred to here as Philip Reed of General Electric, one of the major U.S. corporations that was a player on the American side of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. The two of them lobbied for the European Recovery Plan, popularly known as the Marshall Plan, which is the fourth major capital flow that we're going to be looking at in these segments. Turning once again to the splendid blonde beast, Christopher Simpson writes as follows, "The reports of Brown and Reed were in reality briefs for the European Recovery Program, the Marshall Plan. They illustrate the extent to which that enormously popular and respected program became entangled with the revival of German businessmen who had participated in Nazi crimes. Particularly important in this effort was the, quote, Committee for the Marshall Plan, unquote, founded in September of 1947. It labeled itself a citizens' organization, but was in reality funded and administered by the same economic and foreign policy elite that has been discussed thus far. Its initial sponsors included Averill Harriman and Robert Levette, who will be remembered from the Brown Brothers Harriman Bank, Alan Dulles, Dean Acheson, Winthrop Aldrich, chairman of the Chase Bank, Philip Reed of General Electric, and others of similar stature, most of whom had been active in U.S.-German finance since the 1920s. Labor was represented by hardline anti-communists active in the CIA-sponsored penetration of European trade unions, such as James Carey and David Dubinsky. The Marshall Plan operated as a, quote, distinguished propaganda committee, unquote, as AT&T executive Arthur Page described it. Its goal was never described as the revitalization of the German business elite, but rather as, quote, saving Europe, unquote, and, quote, providing American jobs, unquote, through implementation of the Marshall Plan. But whatever one may think of the plan, the restoration of much of the pre-war German corporate elite was an integral part of the package. General Clay used the case of Deutsche Bank director Hermann Abs to explain this concept. Quote, "We were never able to make Hermann Abs the financial minister of Germany as we would have," unquote, Clay remembered in the same interview quoted earlier, "because of the German and American public's refusal to accept a man who had been so deeply compromised during the Hitler years. But not to worry," Clay continued, again quoting, "we were able to finally put him in charge of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was somewhat outside of government," unquote, "and which was instrumental in distribution of Marshall Plan funds for Germany." Sponsors of the Committee for the Marshall Plan were simultaneously at the cutting edge of renewed efforts to invest in German industry. Quote, "If you have been trying unsuccessfully to get to Germany to reestablish pre-war business contacts, don't be discouraged," unquote, Businessweek told its readers in early 1947. Again quoting, "You can expect a program for reviving business in Western Germany to be pushed by all U.S. factions. Republican backing was assured when John Foster Dulles, Republican spokesman, recently called for the revival of business in Germany and Western Europe, whatever the price. German goods are already trickling into the U.S. market. Anticipating some consumer resistance in the U.S., military government authorities have shrewdly met customs requirements by marking them Made in Germany, U.S. Zone. Before large-scale arrivals of German goods begin, Washington is likely to release a press barrage explaining that German exports help pay U.S. occupation costs in Germany," unquote. Shortly after its founding, the Committee for the Marshall Plan placed full-page advertisements in the most influential U.S. newspapers, sent thousands of personally addressed telegrams signed by the former Secretary of War, Henry L. Stimson, to businessmen asking for their donations and political support, and made a mass mailing to hundreds of thousands of U.S., quote, opinion leaders, unquote, in the upper strata of business, media, labor, and social organizations. The group chartered Marshall Plan clubs in a dozen cities, opened business offices in New York and Washington, and initiated a series of heavily publicized meetings between President Truman and business leaders designed to convey the impression of broad popular support for the Marshall Plan. As Congressman Charles Plumley, a Republican from Vermont, put it, quote, "There has never been so much propaganda in the whole history of the nation as there has been for the Marshall Plan," unquote. The campaign created a, quote, "overwhelming conviction among the American people and among members of Congress that we must have the Marshall Plan right now," unquote, he continued. The claim of overwhelming support, unquote, was in fact overblown. Public opinion polls of the period indicate that about 65% of the U.S. population either opposed the Marshall Plan or did not know what it was. Even so, the Marshall Plan passed the Congress by a large margin. The plan sponsored used the relatively broad popular support for doing something constructive about Europe as a means of putting through the distinctly unpopular idea of reestablishing the German economic elite. And that economic elite was indeed reestablished, turning once again to Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson. The German economic elite and corporations that had been active under Hitler have continued for the most part, though without the Nazi rhetoric and police state powers of the Nazi period. There were, of course, generational changes in the leadership of German companies in the years following the war, and other reforms took place in response to pressure from German unions and international competition. But the fundamental pattern in German finance and industry has been continuity and stability. And the restoration or perpetuation of the German financial and industrial elite by their American compatriots on the American side of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that I consider to be the dominant force in the 20th century ultimately set the stage for not only the perpetuation of the Bormann organization. An attempt to interdict that organization was deep sixed at the end of World War II. But it set the stage for the next major capital flow, the fifth capital flow, which goes from the 750 Bormann corporate fronts in neutral countries back into Germany to help with the West German economic revival in the mid-1950s. This fifth capital flow in this hydraulic paradigm that we're looking at is described by Paul Manning as follows in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Money continued to trickle into West German firms from the private investment sector during the late 40s, but not until May 5th, 1955, when the Federal Republic of Germany became a sovereign government and the Allied occupation forces had left, did the enormous sums shifted from the Third Reich away from threatened Allied seizure become available to those groups in West Germany that had participated in Martin Bormann's program of flight capital. And, of the status of the Bormann Organization as of 1981, a major player in the world economic situation, Paul Manning writes as follows. As for Martin Bormann, this now elderly recluse, by the way, this as of 1981, is ever a keen watcher and manipulator in the silent, gigantic struggles among worldwide industrial and financial powers. Atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany through banks, voting rights enjoyed by majority shareholders and significant cartels, and the professional input of a relatively young leadership group of lawyers, investment specialists, bankers, and industrialists, he is satisfied that he achieved his aim of helping the fatherland back on its feet. To ensure continuity of purpose and direction, a close watch is maintained on the profit statements and management reports of corporations under its control elsewhere. This leadership group of 20, which is in fact a board of directors, is chaired by Bormann, but power is shifted to the younger men who will carry on the initiative that grew from that historic meeting in Strasbourg on August 10, 1944. Skipping down. What will not pass is the economic influences of the Bormann organization, whose commercial directives are obeyed almost without question by the higher echelons of West German finance and industry. All orders come from the shareholders in South America, unquote, I have been told by a spokesman for Martin Bormann. And the power of that organization comes from these capital flows in the 20th century. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KFJC Month of Mayhem Memorial Day Weekend Uncle Sam and the Swastika Special, the story of the collaboration between American corporate interests and the fascist powers of World War II. You just heard an analysis of the five of the major capital flows, I believe the five most important tides of capital flow in the 20th century. Bear in mind when listeners hear me talking about the Bormann Organization, that is the culmination of those five principal capital flows of the 20th century. It is not some sort of weird or arcane analysis on my part. It's just something that people are not accustomed to hearing about. The Bormann Group is, in all likelihood, it appears to be the largest landowner in Latin America, the largest lender in Latin America. It's the second largest stockholder in Standard Oil of New Jersey behind the Rockefeller stock block. And dominates the economy of Germany and Europe. It is a huge and very powerful and significant thing, despite the fact that people don't hear much about it. Now, hearing about it is something that you're about to do. What I'm going to do next is to play the 2 half-hour segments that summarize the Paul Manning book on Martin Bormann. These two segments are available for airplay only. They're not available as a separate entity from Spitfire, although there are plenty of other tapes involving analysis of the Borman organization that are available from Spitfire. So what we're going to do is to get to the first half hour of this two-half-hour segment, dealing with the Borman organization. When listeners, regular listeners to One Step Beyond, hear me talking about the Borman Group, this is what I am talking about, okay? This first side is a half hour in length. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go. Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next two half-hour segments, we're going to examine the reality of the post-World War II Nazi flight capital operations, this to be contrasted with the popular journalistic fantasies of same. One of the things that is somewhat amusing, at least to yours truly, as well as to other people who are serious students of the Second World War and its aftermath, are the recent spate of stories about the Nazi gold exiting through Switzerland to neutral countries. And indeed, I think that although Switzerland was certainly deeply involved in that Nazi flight capital program, I am of the opinion that the Swiss have been unfairly singled out because the activities that they were involved in were worldwide in scope and involved the United States as much, if not more, than other countries. We're going to begin with our examination of the reality of the Nazi flight capital program with a Wall Street Journal article from April 28th of 1997. This was researched for us by a listener. This is an article entitled, Nazi Money Trail Heats Up 50 Years Later, subtitled, Banks and Nations Are Opening Treasure Trove of Records. It's by Greg Steinmetz of the Wall Street Journal, and it reads in part as follows. According to testimony after World War II, an SS officer named Kurt Becker, B-E-C-H-E-R, collected millions of dollars in gold, banknotes, and jewels from Jews seeking to buy their freedom from the Nazis. After the war, Colonel Becker built a successful Bremen-based grain company, Becker GmbH, now owned by ConAgra Incorporated of the U.S. Much of the ransom money was never found, according to the Nazi-hunting Simon Wiesenthal Center. Colonel Becker's name is on a list of 234 powerful Germans the Los Angeles-based Wiesenthal Center believes stashed money abroad during the war. It has asked banks in former Nazi havens such as Argentina to open their books and come clean on the Nazi accounts. Quote, you can't have closure until you investigate the perpetrator's account, says Wiesenthal President Rabbi Marvin Heyer. As the fight over Nazi gold intensifies, bringing forth new details on the complicity of supposedly neutral countries with the Germans, the bank matter highlights just how much is still unknown about the Third Reich money trail. Despite a half century of research by historians, it still isn't clear what happened to much of the billions of dollars worth of gold, jewelry, cash, and artworks plundered by the Nazis to finance the war and line their own pockets. And skipping down, one of the central elements in the Nazi flight capital program, as well as the remarkable post-war Borman organization, about which we will speak in a minute, were some of the neutral countries and indeed some of the corporations that were deeply involved through cartel agreements and standard business arrangements with the major German corporations that underlay the financial and military power of the Third Reich. By the way, I've talked about the incalculably important American corporate connections to Nazism and fascism in numerous programs, including the first two RFA shows, RFA number 10, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, among others. Continuing with this Wall Street Journal article, one of the more complicated gold transactions involved Sweden's wealthy Wallenberg family. After the war started, the Wallenbergs secretly agreed to take over the U.S. arm of Germany's Bosch AG, now known as Robert Bosch GmbH, with the condition that Bosch could buy it back later. American Bosch Corporation in Springfield, Massachusetts, made electronic parts for the U.S. military and thus served as a, quote, kind of intelligence service, unquote, for its German parent, says Dutch writer Gerald Alders, capital A-L-D-E-R-S. Seeing through the arrangement, U.S. officials seized the company in 1942. Bosch bought back the stock to free itself of interest payments promised the Wallenbergs, using Reichsbank gold to pay for it, according to documents unearthed by Swedish journalists. And skipping down, of the Nazi flight capital program, this article alludes to a critical meeting that took place in Strasbourg in Alsace-Lorraine in August of 1944, and that will be our point of departure for the discussion of the remarkable Borman organization. After it became clear that Germany would lose the war, top Nazis began preparing for a comeback and plotting ways to pay for it. A French double agent who spoke to the Allies claimed that officials from Rheinmetall AG, Krupp AG, now known as Fried Krupp AG Hesch Krupp, Messerschmitt AG, Volkswagen AG, and other companies met at a Strasbourg hotel in August of 1944 to discuss financing plans for the Fourth Reich. Well, as I said, the amusing part or an amusing aspect to the recent coverage of the Nazi gold and the flight capital to neutral countries is that this is not news. This has been known for a long time. And beyond that, the reality of the Nazi flight capital program goes infinitely beyond anything that has been discussed in any of these stories. And in fact, the Nazi flight capital program resulted in the successful establishment and, in my analysis, I believe ultimately the triumph of the Underground Reich. Now, that'll sound like absolute drivel to the uninitiated. The fact of the matter is, as I've documented in numerous programs, notably RFA 37, the Third Reich did not disappear but went underground after the Second World War, following a carefully laid and altogether successful plan. And indeed, if my analysis is correct, I believe that the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, the economic component of the Underground Reich, will ultimately prove to be dominant in human affairs, if it isn't already, and I believe that it will prove to be the critical element in the future history of the world, that is to say, the victorious element in the future history of the world. I believe the future will be theirs. For our analysis of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization and its genesis, we're going to rely on a remarkable book which perhaps represents to journalism and history as remarkable an accomplishment as the Bormann Organization represents to industry, finance, and to military and political struggle. This book is entitled Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It's authored by Paul Manning, who was part of the CBS News team covering World War II, along with Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. The book was published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart Incorporated. It was copyrighted 1981, and the ISBN number is 0-8184-0309-8. And the story of the Bormann Organization begins with the aforementioned meeting in Strasbourg in August of 1944. And again, this meeting has been known for quite some time. The decision to hold that meeting and the plan for a flight capital organization to reestablish Germany's dominance after the Second World War was laid by Martin Bormann. Bormann, the Reichsleiter, was Hitler's top aide and toward the end of the war became the leader of Nazi Germany and remained the leader of the Underground Reich, literally the Third Reich gone underground. In Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Paul Manning writes, Martin Bormann was now, this is in 1944, Martin Bormann was now the leader, in fact, of Germany. Hitler, exhausted, drained of the charisma of the glory days of the 30s and the conquest years of the early 40s, was going through the gestures of military leadership mechanically as his troops fell back on all fronts. Martin Bormann, 41 at the fall of Berlin and strong as a bull, was at all times at Hitler's side, impassive and cool. His be-all and end-all was to guide Hitler and now to make the decisions that would lead to the eventual rebirth of his country. Hitler, his intuitions at peak level despite his crumbling physical and mental health in the last years of the Third Reich, realized this and approved of it. Bury your treasure, he advised Bormann, for you will need it to begin a Fourth Reich, unquote. That is precisely what Bormann was about when he set in motion the flight capital scheme August 10, 1944 in Strasbourg. The treasure, the golden ring he envisioned for the new Germany, was the sophisticated distribution of national and corporate assets to safe havens throughout the neutral nations of the rest of the world. Martin Bormann knew in his heart that the war in Germany was over when Normandy was lost. The day Hitler's troops were defeated at the Falaise Gap was the day he ordered swing industrialists of Germany to Strasbourg to hear his plans for Germany's future. And Paul Manning writes of this meeting in Strasbourg as follows. Reichsleiter Martin Bormann himself had ordered the conference, and although he would not physically be present, he had confided to Dr. Scheid, that's S-C-H-E-I-D, who was to preside, quote, the steps to be taken as a result of this meeting will determine the post-war future of Germany, unquote. The Reichsleiter had added, quote, German industry must realize that the war cannot now be won and must take steps to prepare for a post-war commercial campaign which will in time ensure the economic resurgence of Germany, unquote. It was August 10th, 1944. The Mercedes-Benz bearing SS Obergruppenführer Scheid moved slowly now through the narrow streets of Strasbourg. Dr. Scheid noticed that this was a most agreeable city, the one to return to after the war. And skipping down of the meeting, Manning writes, "A transcript of that meeting is in my possession. It is a captured German document from the files of the U.S. Treasury Department and states who was present and what was said as the economy of the Third Reich was projected onto a post-war profit-seeking track." By the way, this document emerged as part of Operation Safe Haven, an Allied intelligence operation aimed at interdicting the Third Reich's flight capital. That operation was itself interdicted when the residue of the Third Reich allied with the United States, Britain, and France in the post-war period. That alignment, of course, against the former Soviet Union. Continuing of the meeting, Manning writes, "Present were Dr. Kaspar, representing Krupp, Dr. Tolle, representing Rohling, Dr. Sincerin, representing Messerschmitt, Drs. Kopp, Veer, and Berwanger, representing Rheinmetall, Captain Haberkorn and Dr. Ruhe, representing Büssing, Drs. Ellenmayer and Cardos, representing Volkswagenwerk, Engineers Drosse, Janchu, and Kopschem, representing various factories in Posen, Poland, Drosse, Janchu and Company, Braun Boveri Herculeswerke, Buchswerke, and Stadtwerke, Dr. Meyer, an official of the German Naval Ministry in Paris, and Dr. Stroessner of the Ministry of Armament, Paris." By the way, I may be mispronouncing some of these names. I don't speak German. Continuing. "Dr. Scheidt, papers from his briefcase arranged neatly on the table before him, stated that all industrial materiel in France was to be evacuated to Germany immediately. The Battle of France is lost to Germany," he admitted, quoting Reichsleiter Bormann as his authority, and again quoting, "and now the defense of the Siegfried Line and Germany itself is the main problem. From now on, German industry must take steps in preparation for a post-war commercial campaign, with each industrial firm making new contacts and alliances through foreign firms. This must be done individually and without attracting any suspicion. However, the party and the Third Reich will stand behind every firm with permissive and financial support," unquote. He assured those present that the frightening law of 1933 known as Treason Against the Nation, which mandated the death penalty for violation of foreign exchange regulations or concealing of foreign currency, was now null and void on direct order of Reichsleiter Bormann. Dr. Scheidt also affirmed, quote, "The ground must now be laid on the financial level for borrowing considerable sums from foreign countries after the war," unquote. As an example of the kind of support that had been most useful to Germany in the past, Dr. Scheidt cited the fact that, quote, "patents for stainless steel belong to the Chemical Foundation Incorporated New York and the Krupp Company of Germany jointly, and that of the United States Steel Corporation Carnegie, Illinois, American Steel and Wire, National Tube, etc., were thereby under an obligation to work with the Krupp concern," unquote. He also cited the Zeiss Company, the Leica Company, and the Hamburg America Line as typical firms that had been especially effective in protecting German interests abroad. By the way, I would note that these complicated corporate and cartel connections and their profound influence on the growth of the Third Reich are discussed in, among other programs, Uncle Sam and the Swastika. I would also note that the Bush family was deeply involved, that's the family of George Bush, with the Hamburg America Line. Continuing of Dr. Scheidt's address, he gave New York addresses to the 12 men. Glancing at his watch, Dr. Scheidt asked for comments from each of the 12 around the table. Then he adjourned the morning session for lunch. And at the afternoon session, Dr. Scheidt also discussed the plans for the industrial concerns of Germany abroad to basically serve as a base for the continuation of the Nazi Party underground, both abroad and in Germany, and also mentioned that, correctly, that many of the leaders of the Third Reich would be viewed as war criminals after the war, and that they were to be placed with various German firms abroad. Of this, Manning writes, "A smaller conference in the afternoon was presided over by Dr. Bosse of the German Armaments Ministry. It was attended only by representatives of Hecko, Krupp, and Rohling. Dr. Bosse restated Bormann's belief that the war was all but lost, but that it would be continued by Germany until certain goals to ensure the economic resurgence of Germany after the war had been achieved. He added that German industrialists must be prepared to finance the continuation of the Nazi Party, which would be forced to go underground just as had the Maquis in France." And skipping ahead, "From this day, German industrial firms of all rank were to begin placing their funds and, wherever possible, key manpower abroad, especially in neutral countries. Dr. Bosse advised that, quote, two main banks can be used for the export of funds for firms who have made no prior arrangements. the Basler Handelsbank, and the Schweizerische Kreditanstalt of Zurich, unquote. He also stated, again quoting, there are a number of agencies in Switzerland which, for a 5% commission, will buy property in Switzerland for German firms using Swiss cloaks. Dr. Bossa closed the meeting, observing that, quote, after the defeat of Germany, the Nazi Party recognizes that certain of its best-known leaders will be condemned as war criminals. However, in cooperation with the industrialists, it is arranging to place its less conspicuous but most important members with various German factories as technical experts or members of its research and designing offices, unquote. And one of the central aspects in the German flight capital operation, and it was very successfully realized, were the profound corporate connections between the large German corporations and their counterparts in other countries, including and especially the United States. Central among those German corporations, with its net of cartel agreements with foreign corporations, was the powerful and landmark IG Farben company, the German dyestuffs industry, one of the most important industrial concerns in the history of free enterprise. Continuing with Manning's account of IG Farben's role in the flight capital program, Manning writes, IG Farben had been the largest single earner of foreign exchange for Germany during the years of the Third Reich. Its operations in Germany included control of 380 companies with factories, power installations, and mines, as well as vast chemical establishments. It operated in 93 countries, and the sun never set on IG Farben, which had a participation both acknowledged and concealed in over 500 firms outside Germany. They grew, as the Third Reich did, and as German armies occupied each country in Europe, they were followed by Farben technicians who built further factories and expanded the IG investment to 7 billion Reichsmarks. The Farben cartel agreements involving trade and the related use of its chemical patents also numbered over 2,000, including such major industrial concerns as Standard Oil of New Jersey, now Exxon, the Aluminum Company of America, by the way, that's Alcoa, E.I. DuPont de Nemours, that of course is DuPont, Ethyl Export Corporation, Imperial Chemical Industries of Great Britain, the Dow Chemical Company, Roman Haas, Establishment Kuhlmann in France, and the Mitsui interests of Japan. I.G. Farben was a formidable ally for Reichsleiter Bormann as his plans in his plans for the post-war economic rebirth of Germany. In a telephone conversation with Dr. von Schnitzler, Bormann asked what would be the loss of factories in France and the other occupied countries, beginning again. In a telephone conversation with Dr. von Schnitzler, Bormann asked what would the loss of factories in France and the other occupied countries mean to German industry in general and to IG in particular. Dr. von Schnitzler said he believed the technical dependence of these countries on IG would be so great that despite German defeat, IG, in one way or another, could regain its position of control of the European chemical business. Quote, they will need the constant technical help of IG's scientific laboratories as they do not own appropriate installations within themselves, he further told Bormann, adding that he and other industrialists such as Hermann Röchling, quote, do not think much of Hitler's recent declaration of a scorched earth policy for Germany. Destruction of our factories will surely inhibit Germany's recovery in the post-war world, he affirmed. Bormann pondered this exchange with von Schnitzler. It was then that he determined to countermand Hitler's order for the ruthless destruction of German industry. He was aware also that the Gauleiters, the regional political supervisors and area commanders of the party who reported to him as party chief, shared the same view as expressed by Dr. von Schnitzler. By the way, I would note in passing that one of the aspects that made the German flight, the Bormann flight capital program, so successful was the fact that as the Nazis conquered various countries in Europe, their economies were basically grafted on to the German economy so that the German corporations retained control of the major corporations of the countries Germany had conquered even after the war. And again, the cartel agreements of the various large German corporations, IG Farben among them, in particular their cartel agreements with American corporations, were front and center to the operations of the flight capital program, one of the reasons that I think the condemnation of Switzerland is quite hypocritical. One of the things that Martin Bormann did in order to assure the success of the flight capital program was to set up 750 new corporations in neutral countries to handle the flight of the assets of the Third Reich. Paul Manning writes about this as follows. 750 new corporations were established in the last months of the war under the direction of Reichsleiter Bormann using the technique perfected by Hermann Schmitz. By the way, that's Hermann Schmitz of IG Farben, one of the luminaries of the IG, just like Dr. von Schnitzler. Continuing. A national of each country was the nominal head of each corporate structure, and the board was a mix of German administrators and bank officials, while the staffing at senior and middle management levels was comprised of German scientists and technicians. In the background were the shadowy owners of the corporation, those Germans who possessed the bearer bonds as proof of stock ownership. The establishment of such companies, usually launched in industries requiring high technical skills, was welcomed in Spain and Argentina, to give two examples, because those governments appreciated that German companies would generate jobs and implement a more favorable balance of trade. Country by country, a breakdown by U.S. Treasury investigators of these new 750 German firms was as follows. Portugal, 58. Spain, 112. Sweden, 233. Switzerland, 214. Turkey, 35. And Argentina, 98. More about the successful flight of German assets. The movement of German assets into Switzerland had also gone well, Bormann noted from his reports. Flight capital investments had been accomplished principally through the establishment of subsidiaries of powerful German firms. Over half the total German capital in Switzerland was used in setting up holding companies representing IG Farben, Merck, Siemens, Osram, Henkel, and others. By the way, I would note that the Merck company, a major German corporation, has been one of the major corporations involved with the U.S. post-World War II biological warfare program. It is also one of the largest manufacturers of vaccines in the world. It dispenses vaccines to the United States Army, and it also manufactured the experimental hepatitis B vaccine program, which many believe was responsible for the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. Continuing. Of the 750 companies and the holding companies for these major German corporations, Manning writes, a holding company may not trade in any form. It may only hold stock in other companies, but through this device, the existing German firms and the 750 new corporations established under the Bormann program gave themselves absolute control over a post-war economic network of viable, prosperous companies that stretched from the Ruhr to the neutrals of Europe and to the countries of South America, a control that continues today and is easily maintained through the bearer bonds or shares issued by these corporations to cloak real ownership. Bearer shares require no registration of identity, for such shares are exactly what they mean. The bearer of the majority shares controls the company without needing a vestige of proof as to how he acquired them. Thus, the Germans who participated as a silent force in Bormann's post-war commercial campaign, which is sometimes referred to by aging Nazis as Operation Eagle's Flight or Aktion Adlerflug, ensured their command over the industrial and financial institutions that were to move the new Federal Republic of Germany back into the forefront of world economic leadership. In Switzerland, the most substantial investments were in chemicals and drugs and in electric power and equipment. German investments totaled $300 million, of which bank deposits, cash, and securities amounted to about $250 million, with direct investments about $50 million. In the German-Swiss clearings, Germany's debt, as the new year of 1945 began, was 1,000 million Swiss francs, or $232.1 million. Swiss investments in Germany and pre-war loans to Germany were $445 million. Six Swiss private banks were now used by German firms in the flight capital program. H. Stutzenegger in C., Rochling & Company, Johann Verli & Company, Bank Wadenswil, Basler Handelsbank, and Credinstalt. Again, I may be mispronouncing some of these names. However, all major Swiss banks were serving the Germans in the massive movement of funds. The big German banks, Deutsche, Dresdner, and Commerzbank, all had their regular Swiss affiliations through which they worked. Deutsche had as its principal connection Credit Suisse and also did business with the Swiss Bank Corporation and the Bank Federal. Banks transferred from Berlin for a client list approved by Bormann went into numbered account, or funds transferred from Berlin for a client list approved by Bormann went into numbered accounts and were either held there for local investment or soon shifted to neutral nations elsewhere in Europe or overseas to be credited to the accounts of appropriate German corporate subsidiaries
or else to entirely new corporations awaiting these startup monies that would enable them to go into business using German patents. As these new corporations prospered, they generated more money and profits, becoming important elements in the Bormann global economic scheme.